Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, I'm excited to have Eddie Wilson. Eddie, thanks for doing this. You've done a lot of interesting things, media, real estate, private equity, the Spire tour is getting so huge. I'm interested how you introduce yourself when you're at a party and people ask, what do you do?
Yeah, so I introduce myself in three ways. There's three big components of my life. Number one, I'm a corporate leader. I still lead organizations. I lead nearly 23 companies under our corporate umbrella. I also am an investor, so I'm actively investing in real estate, private equity, various other things. And then lastly, an altruist. For me, life is about purpose, and it's about aligning all of those things towards purpose.
That's great. Well, can you give us the run-up to pre-billion-dollar private equity fund, and then we'll go post, and what you're up to now?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I grew up in the home of an entrepreneur who really got a lot of those wheels in motion for me. My dad, his own multiple businesses, and he left kind of corporate world and started on his own, and took a lot of the fear out of what I'm pursuing today. You know, I watched my dad succeed, fail, you know, have little, have abundance, and, you know, always was an amazing father. And so he spent a lot of time with me, and a lot of that rubbed off through osmosis, whatever it was. And, you know, put that bug inside of me that I could create for others. I could create jobs for others. I could create opportunities for others and ultimately create a life for myself and my family. And so, you know, growing up in an entrepreneur's home, my mother, ironically, is also an entrepreneur. So she's had multiple businesses. So I come by it honestly, and left broadcasting school, went into broadcasting for about 3 or 4 years, managed some TV and radio assets, and then decided I really wanted to build something of my own. And had a great exit in the beginning, sold a television show to a major network, and realized that I could actually create something with substance and value that people would pay me exponential value on it to take the opportunity for the future. And for me, it kind of set something off in my head, because even though my father had built a lot of businesses, he had never exited any businesses. You know, he'd never been paid. And that really set inside of my kind of life and mind this idea that I could create something in a short amount of time and then really shortcut time by selling something that I didn't have to do for the next 5, 7, 10 years, but be paid for the next 5, 7, 10 years worth of work. And if there's one thing that sets me apart, it's my meticulous approach and intention with time. And when I realized that I could shorten time and get to the end result in a quicker way by buying and selling companies, that really began this process. And so in 2019, I had a private equity firm that I owned and operated that owned 86 assets. I look at private equity a lot different than others. I typically own and operate these assets. So when I'm making investments, I'm actually the operator. I have an operational team. So we're taking, you know, ownership and primary residence in that business. And then we will operate it as we see fit and try to get it to its highest and best use. And so in 2019, we had 86 assets. And in that year, we sold 76 of those assets. We sold them in groups of 3, 4, 5, 10. One of those was a large insurance company. And that was the big exit that most people talk about. You know, we sold for about $1.27 billion in that time period for all those assets. And obviously, I had lots of other partners in the deals and things like that. But that was the kind of the big catapult to what I do in private equity today.
That's exciting. By the way, what was your TV show concept that you sold?
So it was, it's one that I still am not by contract allowed to talk about, but okay. I sold a big national talk show. So a conservative talk television show.
Okay. And then post exit, you've got so many options. How did you decide what you wanted to do next after selling, you know, 86 businesses for $1.2 billion?
Sure. Yeah, so for me, that started a little earlier. When I sold the first television program, I really understood this process of exiting. I then ended up selling an advertising agency that I owned and really was taken advantage of by the buyers. And that's a crazy story how all that happened. But in the end, I left a lot of money on the table. And in that moment, I decided I'm going to play this game at a different level. These guys obviously know something that I don't. And instead of allowing that to be kind of a ceiling in my life. It was like, no, I'm going to go learn how they play it because they play this way different than I do. I'm missing some pieces and I've got to figure this out. And so that really was the catalyst into all of the additional businesses. So, but what I learned before even the 86 companies and the 76 exits was that, you know, money and all of the benefits of running companies or being identified with companies really left me with a sense of loss, emptiness, a lack of fulfillment. And I began to walk down this path in 2013 of trying to find purpose, trying to find fulfillment in my life, and found that really impacting others that can or could not impact themselves really gave me a ton of fulfillment in my life. And so we started doing a lot of feeding projects and educational projects in Central America. And that led to the foundation that I have today called Impact Others. And so now most of my companies I'm building today have a complete altruistic bend to them that I'm building these companies specific to just pump more capital into these opportunities with orphanages, feeding centers, clean water projects, and building sustainable businesses around the world.
That's exciting. Which countries have you focused on so far?
So we're in 108 countries right now. There's, you know, give or take 196 in the world. And we have focused, we started in India and had a huge focus in India and then really broadened out. I started giving in Honduras and started looking at Central America, but we actually planted our flag in India. That was one of our big first countries that we tried to make major impact in. And now we have two big sites in India. Own a broadcasting company in India. But we now are in a ton of countries. We're all over Southeast Asia, Asia. We're all over Africa, Northern Africa, Southern Africa, Central Africa, West Africa. We're all over Central America, South America. We do very little work here in the United States, but we do a ton overseas.
And how do you decide, okay, which one, you know, this is going to be the water project. This is going to be, what does that decision tree look like? Because there's so much you could give to, right?
Yes, and it's insatiable. You know, that's why I ended up building the current private equity firm I have today was because no matter what you exit for, you could exit for $10 billion and the need in the world is greater than you still can service. You know, that was my experience was like, oh, I have this capital. I could go do something with it. And then you start doing something with it and you realize like, oh, the need in the world is far greater than I could ever accomplish without additional capital. So the decision tree today is we, number one, we look at our partnerships in overseas. So we have 14 partners that are regionalized that are outside of the United States. And as they steward the money and resources and opportunities, it flows through them. Some of them do a fantastic job. Some of them do an amazing job. You know, like there are some that are just unbelievable. And typically it starts with that because that's the biggest and hardest thing to accomplish overseas is channeling the capital properly and having the checks and balances on it to know that what you put the capital out there for is actually being accomplished. So it first starts with our 14 regional directors. They submit the opportunities and, you know, things that are going on. And typically as I travel the world, I'm filtering those opportunities that I'm coming in contact with back through them. Or if I speak at our Aspire conference and I talk about altruism or giving back and someone says, I have a water project in Nigeria, you know, how do I find out if you guys can help? And so I would funnel that back through our regional director there. So it funnels through that. Then we really then break it down by percentage. All of our donations, we still donate probably 70% of the capital we use. And our model is a little bit different. I take care of all the overhead. I like every donation just going 100% into the field. So I take care of all the overhead. I pay for any overhead here in the US and overhead overseas personally through our companies. And then every dollar I donate, I want it to go to making an impact on someone else. So about 70% is our companies. It's my, you know, wealth that I've created or the companies that I have are just generating profit and feeding into it. And then 30% come from donors today. So then we break it down by percentage and we try to do 30% in clean water. We do 40% in feeding and housing children. We do another 30% in education. Then we do 10% in building sustainable small businesses. The building of sustainable small businesses has been a catalyst for us though, because we build them in the region where we're serving, and then we take the profit from those businesses and we feed them back in. And so this year at our board meeting, which is coming up in 2 weeks, our annual board meeting, I'm going to propose that I think we should be putting 20% into the small businesses because it's generating so much more revenue that just stays into that country, doesn't have to be repatriated, doesn't have to be sent overseas, and it gets to be managed by this fiduciary, which is the regional director.
Okay, this is so great. I can't believe this hasn't come up on any of our previous calls. Like, I'm so excited you do this.
Yeah.
what's the website if people want to find out more?
Yeah, you can go to impactothers.com. And it talks a lot about these four big modalities of how we give and how we make impact in the world.
Great. So let's talk about the business you're doing now and talk about what's going on, and including Aspire and all the other things.
Sure. Yeah. So we have a private equity firm called Collective Influence. My business partner, Andrew Cordell, and I, we started this about a year ago now. And it really was for the intent of putting more capital into Impact Others. So when we started this a year ago, we seeded it with some capital and we're really looking at building communities. And my thesis on private equity is you build community, then you through data science, understand what that community needs, wants, desires, and then you serve that community through building products or services. And so usually our acquisitions or our startups are intentional to the data that our communities already have. So one of the communities we wanted to start was a small business community. I feel like that's the strength and backbone of our country. It is the American dream. It used to be the American dream was go get a job that you work for 50 years, buy a house. Today it's start a small business, have the freedom that you want, you know, build a sustainable opportunity, create legacy for your family. Like that's the American dream today. And so we wanted to build that community. And the way that we build community is by offering massive value. So we have a real estate community, we have a private lending community, we have various other communities that we've built. We own FitCon, which is the fitness community. And Aspire became this massive catalyst that we didn't realize would happen so quickly and with such veracity and velocity. We've built our first conference called the Aspire Tour in February of last year in Dallas. We had around 1,800 people show up. We will be back in Dallas here in the next 2 weeks, and we've already sold out at 4,000 tickets. And we have Madison Square Garden coming up in July that'll be 7,000 tickets. It's just this tour has exploded, and we've seen close to 20,000 people come to an event in the last year. And then we've built services and products around what those people need. So it's been a wild ride because in the first year of Collective Influence's existence, and the reason we call it Collective Influence is we believe that our capital, our vision, our opportunity can only take us so far. And if you really want to make impact in the world, it has to be a collective influence. So that's why we named the firm that. And so now Collective Influence has about 23 assets, 23 companies. And we just got a fourth quarter valuation of over $400 million. And so it's been moving very, very quickly. Another big addition that we had to Collective Influence was we added a third partner named Dan Fleischman, who's very well known in the social media world. And Dan has a couple of assets he brought to the table, such as Cards and Coffee, Everbowl. He has a huge mastermind called the $100 Million Mastermind, and various other things. So it's been moving very, very quickly.
That's exciting. So the event business is fascinating to me because it's always felt like such a black box. Can you give people a flavor of some of the headline and keynote speakers that you guys are having through Aspire?
Sure. We want people with social influence who are willing to be vulnerable and speak towards their success and their failures. That was kind of our simple philosophy when we started. But we want them to be A-list celebrities. That's harder than it looks to actually, number one, go get the A-list celebrities, but also to get ones that are actually willing to be vulnerable, because most of the time who they are is perceived on screen or, you know, through opportunities, and they don't want to hurt their opportunities by being too ultra vulnerable. But our list of celebrities that have spoken so far have been people like Marcus Lemonis from The Prophet, Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank, Mark Cuban from Shark Tank, Alex Rodriguez, the famous baseball player from the New York Yankees, Magic Johnson, the comedian Kevin Hart has been a fantastic addition to the to the group. We've had all kinds of really fascinating, interesting ones. Jesse Itzler has been super fascinating, a crowd favorite. His wife, Sarah Blakely, who created Spanx. We've had a fantastic lineup of celebrities, athletes, you know, big business moguls. It's been fantastic.
And you got David Goggins coming up this month, right?
We have David Goggins. This will be the second time we've had David. And I believe we've signed him for 4 more shows after this.
That's great. So help me understand the chicken and egg of like paying for a great speaker, selling tickets, and getting the right venues on the dates you want, and coordinating when Kevin Hart can actually be there. And
it is
sounds
tough.
Like a lot of spinning plates.
Our staff does a fantastic job at this, but that is what you just hit on is the hardest part of the event space. Most people would think the hardest part is putting a person in a seat, and that is difficult, and many people struggle with that. But it's harder to get a celebrity to see the value of what you're trying to create, lock down a venue at the right time, the right space, right? And so the early days were really tough. Now that the thing is moving, it's like we have our entire year booked out. We said, here's our, 12 venues. We just lined up the celebrities, who wants in. And now the celebrities are in a place of chasing us, which is way, way better. They call and ask if they can speak at the event versus, us calling and begging and trying to sell them on this idea. But in the early days, it was tough. And we have a bunch of people on our staff. And a lot of people will come to Kevin O'Leary last month came to Santa Clara. I think it was Santa Clara. I don't know. It's been a lot of events in a row every single month. And he was out at the event and he was talking to myself, Andrew, and Alex, who books all of our talent. She spends all of her time with our talent. And he said, this is one of the best events I've ever been a part of. What he was actually speaking about was not just the crowd, because people have crowds. There's always energy at these places. People obviously love him, his kind of expertise and personality on Shark Tank. What he meant was you guys actually have a staff and you run this thing like a machine. And that was the hardest part, is that we don't look at events like an event promoter. I look at it as a private equity firm. And the investment was a loss leader into creating a community that I ultimately would monetize. The story behind the Aspire Tour was that Andrew and I had to be willing to put up about $25 million that may or may not return in order to do, an event series of this magnitude. Now it's almost doubled that over time, but it's been a huge investment, but our investment is paying off currently in dividends because we're serving that community. We understand the community. We built a staff that could collect that data, help us understand that data. And then we had enough capital to go build businesses or acquire businesses that would serve the community.
What's an example of that? What's something that maybe you wouldn't have guessed, but once you got the data, you realized, oh man, what could really help these people is X.
Yeah, the path that we're going down has really, in the beginning, we looked at all types of business services. I have a company called Empire, which is an operating system that helps businesses get the most out of their business. We thought that's a perfect product for it. And really, it's financial services. Financial services are so lacking, and so many of the financial services that we use in the United States today are served by baby boomers who are getting ready to walk away from their practice. And when a baby boomer is your CPA or, your tax architect or whatever it is, and they're looking towards this place of, and a lot of these baby boomers are not just selling their business. They're actually walking out, locking the door, putting the close sign on and just never walking back in, right? Like this is the nature of the 15 million baby boomers that are going to leave their post in the next 5 to 7 years. It's a lot of small business being affected, but the financial services is one of those sectors. And so not only are they potentially going to walk away, but they've stopped investing in technology. They have started to pare down their staff. They've started to just kind of take the clients that they want. They've let some of they're not searching hard for clientele. And the financial services space is one that has a lot of opportunity for roll-ups. It also has the opportunity for creation. One of the companies that we started that is a belief system of Andrew and I's is that we need to create financial vehicles for wealth. people are going to live a whole lot longer than they used to as we progress, right? Like modern medicine, people's conscious, you know, awareness of health, working out, all of these things, modern, it's everything, right? And we better be prepared for the life expectancy and the lifespan of the human to be 100, not 72 or whatever it is, you know? And so we believe that it's important and imperative that people begin to build wealth, not because they need to build wealth just to experience, you know, the pleasures of life, but because it's going to be what sustains them if they live another 15, 20 years, right? And so a lot of the vehicles that are just, you know, not super well known, like we have, we're very into what we call infinite banking. We have built a company called The Family Bank, helping people ultimately keep more of the capital that they produce through life insurance vehicles and things like that, that are overfunded, that are high interest, high yielding. They're really interesting vehicles. When Andrew and I started to talk about that, it was fascinating how few people had ever heard of this. Yet, you know, in my family, we've been doing it for a couple of generations, you know. So companies like that, tax services, CPAs, I never really thought about owning a CPA firm. Like, it just wasn't something I desired. I felt like it was probably a low margin business. You're selling hours, but it's the one thing our people need, you know? And it is easy to roll these up. And most of these CPAs that are, in the baby boomer kind of range are willing to sell for pennies on the dollar because they have no succession plan. They don't have a son or a daughter that's willing to step in and take the business.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What's another secret of the events business that people on the outside who, like, if you want to do like top tier events with you know, celebrities speaking at them, what's something else that, or what's a piece of advice you go back and give yourself if you're starting over?
Sure. We did a couple of things right that served us well. And that was, we partnered with one of the largest marketing firms that had already been doing massive seminars for Tony Robbins and others. And even though it might have been an expense that we were nervous about because it was expensive, having confidence in your marketing is vital. Like, to believe that it is possible that someone can put these people in seats. To spend $1 million on an event, or 1.5 million, or, you know, whatever we're spending today, and then to then, you know, and then to go drop $200,000 or $300,000 or $500,000 in marketing, to believe that that's going to actually pay off is huge. And so we partnered with a fantastic marketing firm. We had an ownership and a partnership with them. And that was very, very helpful. And then the other thing that I would say is don't cheapen out on talent. People come and they experience the event by the person on stage. And, you know, holding that standard extremely high has allowed us to gather a great name and for a lot of people to talk about the great experience. And then the last thing is in the event space, if you're so focused on monetizing the actual event you're in today, you'll ruin the experience. You'll ruin it because you'll try to sell too much. You'll try to get too much from the crowd, and it won't feel like a give. It'll feel like a take. And if somebody pays you to sit there, they expect the value more than just what they paid. They expect the value of their ticket payment and the time that they're putting in to come back to them in exponential form. And if you are so focused on making the money right then off of that event, you're going to ruin the experience and your lifespan is going to be very short.
So between your expensive tickets and your cheap tickets, what does that average out to for an average ticket price?
Yeah, so I think our lowest ticket is around $100. That's our silver. And it goes all the way up to close to $1,000 for a diamond. And the diamond experience, we actually let them get up close and personal with the celebrity, have lunch with them, be taught personally by them. And we make that more of a very inclusive, where we'll sell 100 of those. I think in Dallas, the 4,000 we've sold, I think we may have sold 120 diamond tickets or something like that. So they get a VIP experience. So it's someone that really, you know, is maybe, you know, done very well in their business, and $1,000 for a ticket is not a big expense. But we give massive value to the silvers. We give swag bags to everybody. We love just showering our people with gifts and experience, and we want them all to walk away just raving about the fact that they got that experience for that little money.
Yeah. You know, I'm fascinated with this idea of communities. You know, this fancy house that I'm at in Hawaii today, right? It's a podcast guest who I became friends with that I invited to one of our invite-only events. And I'd done him a bunch of favors. And one day he said, well, what can I do for you, Jess? And I was like, well, nothing. Yeah. I'm good. And he's like, in that case, I'm sending you to Hawaii to go stay at our place for a couple of weeks, right?
And that's awesome.
It's like helping me realize like, oh man, I love the community we've got over these 900 something episodes, but I am really under delivering. Like I should be doing four times as much for these people as I am. What advice would you give to somebody like me who is, you know, they've got a group, they've got some of the right people, but they realize there's more they can do for their people.
Yeah, that's a great thing. My business partner, Andrew, all he thinks about is the experience. And he's the branding guy. You know, like I'm the business guy. I'm nuts and bolts. I want to know, you know, if we're going to make money, lose money. Andrew walks through every event and sits in the seat of the actual person that's going to experience it. And he's very, very particular. It's his skill set. It's his superpower. But he does a podcast. He does a show. And when you walk in, you're greeted. You're taken to a green room in the office. He has a little metal sign. His whole show is called Money Is. The metal sign actually has your face on it. When you actually, you know, are in the podcast with him, he hands you the sign. He asks you to write on the sign, money is what to you? And he's just a master of the experience. And then we hang them on our wall. We send them one of their own. We hang them on our walls, so all over our walls in the office. You see Money Is, the podcast that he does, or the YouTube show that he does. And so, you know, Andrew is very good at that, but we have mastered that art of the experience. And my suggestion is simple. It's that we rarely take the time to actually walk through the experience of the consumer, right? Or the B2B opportunity. You know, it would be what is the experience? What is the communication? Have you experienced it from the guest perspective or point of view? And we take notes on that a lot here. Like we want, for instance, if you come into our office, no matter what your experience is, if you come in for one of my Empire War Rooms or something, we have a massive TV that as you get off the elevators, you're going to be greeted with your face and a welcome. Like we have a team that does that. You are going to be given things that we've invested in, companies we've invested in. We are big coffee people here. I've invested heavy into a coffee company. You're going to experience amazing coffee in our office. You're going to be given swag. You're going to be taken on a tour. You're going to see, you know, feel, taste. But all the way down to Andrew has a favorite scent, and we have special pods made for our diffusers just so that we have our own scent that Andrew is fascinated by. Like it's just, it is an experience, but we do this in every area. When somebody joins our team for the very first time, we got probably 90 to 100 employees here now. Their first day, we want them to remember forever. When they get off the elevator, our entire team is waiting. We don't let them come in until 9:15. And we celebrate and we scream and we cheer and there's music going on and they get to know everybody. We do a photo shoot. We do breakfast. We do everything. And, you know, we've done that so many times. But if you ask any of our employees, do they remember their first day? Part of it, they're a little bit embarrassed because there's 100 people standing there cheering them, you know, cheering for them when they got off the elevator. But we do curate the experience, whether it's Aspire or you work for Collective Influence or you come to one of the shows or, you know, things that we do. And I think that we have to put a high, high, high priority on that because it pays off. You know, like those relationships are built. One last thing I want to say on that. Most people believe that our customer at Aspire is the attendee. While we do treat the customer as the attendee, we actually treat the celebrity as our actual customer. When they come in backstage, it is a curated experience step by step. There's more banners and signage back there than you will ever see anywhere else. They're brought in, security meets them. They're brought into a green room that's lush, has everything, it's private. Andrew and I come in for a little while, we get introduced, we always sit down, talk with them. We actually have a whole TV studio set up there where we interview them about their experience. We have a place where they can sign autographs for stuff. We tell them how we're going to display their autographs. We give them all the social posts afterwards. As they come off, we have a professional photographer sitting there, very, very well-known photographer, we have an entire backdrop set up and we do a whole photo shoot with them. So that, and we send it to their PR team. We have built massive relationships. I mean, within two events, Alex Rodriguez was asking Andrew and I to come have dinner at his house, you know, in Miami. And Andrew and I are down there. And that's because of the experience, right? It's just, it's like what you're talking about. Like, to get invited to Hawaii, you must be doing something right, because, you know, people don't just give that out unless the experience is great.
Yeah. I'm interested. I want to go a different direction. You brought up living longer and lifespan, health span. You know, I've been having more guests on the show recently around longevity and investing in longevity. And it's a fascinating space I'm doing more in now. I'm interested in your thoughts about this idea of, hey, instead of living to 75, you're going to get another 30-something percent of life and go to 100. And people right. are going to need to, like, have something to do and include, they're going to need sure. to be able to fund themselves, right?
Yeah.
As you think about just, like, all these changes that are happening, that, like, that's not a crazy statement that much, much larger portions of the population are going to live to 100 and more. What do you think about that sector? How do you think about that sector?
You know, I think that there's this interim period where people, I believe, will begin to start living longer and longer. And then there's going to be people that, because they're living longer and longer, aspire to live longer and longer. The possibility's there. You know, it's the 4 minute mile when all of a sudden everyone's doing it. It's like, you know, the first guy breaks it, and all of a sudden what is like 10 people in the next 30 days breaks it. It's I think that's what's going to happen, is the dam's going to break. So we are spending a lot of money in research today because we believe that's one of the sectors of the community that we serve, is the entrepreneur who's killing themselves. They're in the grind. They're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. They're giving up free time. They're not going on vacation. They also are coming to this realization that their health is important, and that sometimes business isn't about these quick, fast moments of success. It's about longevity. The people that win are the ones that stay in the game the longest. So one of the big products and, you know, kind of forward processes that we have is this place where we're spending a lot of time on health. We've partnered with a guy by the name of Dr. Jim LaValle. He's been chairman of the Anti-Aging Society. He has 20,000 doctors under him. He's on staff for the Golden State Warriors and a bunch of other pro teams. And now he's the chair of the Peptide Society. And he's fascinating. And so we're actually building a supplement line specific to the entrepreneur's health and needs. And we're taking all this data based on what an entrepreneur goes through, somebody who's starting businesses and running businesses, and what they actually need, and then curating that for them in a way that they could take it very easily, not big bottles, it's blister packs, all kinds of different things. And so we're working through a product series that will serve them, because we really do believe. So I think that's the next sector. And then there's the group that it just becomes the norm, you know, our children. I think our children, you know, I still ate Little Debbie's a lot when I was a kid. You know, I didn't focus on, you know, I still thought the food groups was a thing. You know, like my kids, the way that my kid, you know, I have a 17-year-old that's talking to me about, I got to make sure I get my 162 grams of protein in today. And, you know, he's measuring his food. And I mean, like, it's a different level, you know, and they're growing up in this expectation. You know, they're not pounding sugary foods, and you know, they're very health conscious and aware of their bodies and the performance of their bodies. And so I think that group is what I'm not sure how to serve or capture yet, you know, because there's an expectation we're creating in them that is very, very different. Now, we do have products and services and companies that I think will serve that group of people. For instance, we have a company called Everbowl. Everbowl is like an acai bowl chain store, and there's, you know, we have 26 locations or something. That was a part of the Dan merger. And the large majority of those people that come in there and spend $10, $12, $14 on an acai bowl are not 60 and 70-year-olds. You know, they are 17, 20, 25-year-olds. And I think it's about getting in front of it and understanding that they're creating a lifestyle that won't change. They're not going to go back to cheesecake and Little Debbie's, you know, like they're going to stay on that trajectory, and we better get in front of it and service them.
Yeah. It's a fascinating mindset shift, right? This guy's been on the show a couple times. that's we're doing a mini series this year. Greg Bailey, he sold his biotech companies for $28 billion, and he was talking to me. He got me to read the Peter Attia book, Outlive, and Greg talks about this idea of like medicine 1.0 was like bloodletting and stuff in the 1800s.
Right.
Medicine 2.0 is like, okay, after you're sick, we'll try to treat your cancer, kind of thing.
Sure.
And medicine 3.0 is like, well, what do we have to do earlier so you don't get cancer in the first place? You don't get heart disease, diabetes, dementia in the first place. And like,
right.
I don't know why this was like revolutionary to me. It shouldn't be, but this concept that like most of the problems of the four things that kill people the most, you know, heart disease, cancer, you know, dementia, Alzheimer's, and metabolic stuff, the diabetes and these things, right?
Right.
That like the treatments are kind of like after the cow is out of the barn, it's like your liver is in terrible, terrible shape.
Yeah.
We'll finally start to work on it. And and this idea of like a fundamental approach differently of, like you said, like what can, like, here's my perception and tell me if you see it differently. I feel like entrepreneurs, fund managers, like really ambitious people who wealth accumulation is a priority and hopefully so they can do charitable work with it, right? It's almost like they're willing to sacrifice their health to get in the financial position they'd like to. And then all of a sudden their health becomes a big priority, right?
It's a badge of honor. It's a badge of honor. I speak at business conferences all the time. I mean, every other week I'm at a business conference, and the common language is I'm working 80, 90 hours a week. I'm put it in, but one day, and it's like, it's a badge of honor. You know, like they almost talk about sleep deprivation, being overweight as just, you know, this plight because they got to do it. That's how you build a business. You know, like that's shifting though.
Yeah. Like I think one of my favorite guests we've ever had on the show is Richard Koch, the billionaire that wrote the 80-20 principle. And he's like, the world, like in our businesses, we completely focus on how to get more with less. But then ourselves, we have all accepted this mindset of more with more. Well, I'm going to get more by working more hours, whatever, instead of like, what are these, like the, you know, the hinge that moves the big door, like the, you know, these levers that are so important. And like he works, I think he sold his consulting firm for, I want to say, $5 million. And according to Perry Marshall, he's worth like $1.4 billion. And he did that working like an hour a day, like a couple hours a day, you know, and just but exceedingly intentional on what he was doing, right? Instead of doing everything. And I think it's fascinating. So this is kind of my transition to, I know that you are super intentional about operating a business. Can you tell us about the Empire system?
Sure. Yeah, I'm very intentional because I do believe that business is science. It's not art. And most entrepreneurs treat it as if it's an art form. It's they're coming up with some new creative concept. It's like, we're really not. I mean, for the most part, business is business, products are products, services are services. And so if you understand the science of business, then it makes the art make you stand out, set apart. And so I built an operating system called Empire back when I had the 86 companies. I had 31 and was operating on other systems that it just wouldn't allow me to scale. And really the big fundamental difference was I had companies that were in startup and I had a company that was doing $800 million in top line revenue. So it's like, how do you fundamentally treat them the same? You know, like I have one employee building a tech stack over here and then, you know, that's a company and I've got 4,000 employees over here. You know, it's like, so for me, it was about building a system that transcends all of those phases of business. So I built it for myself. And after I sold the companies, then I began to realize that I'd invested in a consulting firm because I was trying to find deal flow and realized that a lot of the fundamental problems that I had solved in my own businesses could be solved by, you know, for them. So I helped. And then it ended up turning it into a curriculum. It was the COVID year. So it felt like, well, we don't have a lot of time or we have a lot of time to do whatever we want. So I still had some operators that I had sold companies and I told them, hey, I'll go find more companies. Just stay with me. I'll keep paying your salary, your bonus. Just stay with me. So I had some operators that just stayed with me waiting on the next big thing. And we got into some rooms and we began to really turn it into more of a curriculum, something that we could replicate. I wasn't sure if I ever would sell it or I would ever use it as a system or process, but I knew that I would go build more businesses or I would buy more companies. And so I wanted to make sure that I perfected it. And really, I thought I'd write a book, I'd give it to my kids. They'd be like, oh, this is how Dad built the empire. And that would be the end of it. And when it began to get some traction, we started getting a lot of people seeking, like, oh, wait a minute, we heard that you solved this problem, or we heard about your five phases kind of methodology, or whatever it was. You know, we have some very unique things in the Empire Operating System. And now it's just exploded since post-COVID. I think we're at over 3,000 businesses globally, because it really, again, business is science. It doesn't matter if you're a business that operates in China or Spain or the UK or the US. Like, business is still business, and how you measure business, how you make decisions, how you speak about it, the cadence, your language, all of that's, it's a science, right? Like, it's not super difficult if you kind of have the methodology.
So I think about some of like the well-known ones out there, you know, especially for very small businesses, the E-Myth, Michael Gerber, the kind of $2 million to $50 million, the EOS, Gino Wickman, and all those guys. But sometimes I've wondered, okay, great. What if EOS got you to a certain level, but then it works so well? Now, what do you do at 50 million? You know, like,
yeah, that's
do you have
the
thoughts
issue
on this?
I do. And I'm also good friends with all of those guys. I actually was on the phone with Michael Gerber just the other day, like, you know, who is fantastic. And I've gained so much insight through his book. I've spoken to Gino Wickman multiple times. He sold EOS. The fascinating thing about what they've built, and this is not to knock them in any way, because I feel like they were pioneers, is that the biggest and largest business that they've ever built is the company that's actually telling you how to build your business, right? And so Gino Wickman, the largest company ever built was EOS, you know, Traction. And he sold it to a private equity firm. And the reason that it's difficult to go past kind of the $15 to $20 million mark at EOS is because EOS, the founder, Gino, he built a $10 to $20 million business called EOS. And there is a lot more complexity in business. And so when you're focused on small businesses, but you don't understand or you don't have the acumen of a large billion-dollar business. So how do I run a Fortune 500? Then what happens is there's gaps, and when you build it in a silo, and all of a sudden you don't allow yourself for the potential growth. So that's why I believe one of the most revolutionary things that we put out there was the five phases of business, because in each phase there's a transition, but the same language, the same building blocks that you get to use when you get to the next level. So like, our five phases are startup, and we believe that you should start a business very, very intentionally. Start, then you move into perseverance. Perseverance is really the pre-profit phase. You're in and out of profit, you know, you're hiring your cousin and your brother to come in at lower level. It's the small business world, right? It's the things that we do to get to a place where we are successful. Then you move into viability, and that should be the goal of every business. And we've got a very foundational piece in viability. Once you get the viability, then you scale. Scale is number four. And then lastly, succession. What do I do once I've hit the ceiling? Now, between viability and scale, there's so much you have to know. But most entrepreneurs, when they get to perseverance, and I wouldn't even say they're quite viable yet, but they're in perseverance, but they're, you know, QuickBooks account shows them that they've made some profit, right? All of a sudden, they want to take that profit and they want to scale. But the foundation hasn't been built yet, right? Like, for instance, like Grant Cardone, like I love Grant. Andrew and I spent a lot of time with Grant. And you have a guy that gets all pumped up at Grant's show, and he's going to 10X his life and 10X his business and 10X, you know, like 10X, 10X, 10X. And one guy will walk out and he will 10X it. And the other guy will walk out and try the exact same thing and crash and burn, right? Like, destroy his company. And the thing is, because when you do the right things at the wrong time, you still get the wrong result. Doing the right thing at the wrong time still gets you the wrong result. And so it's important that you understand phase by phase. So when we grow businesses, we're checking off, like, have we hit this plateau? Because then we have to institute this next step. That's what no other business operating system does for you, is tells you, hit this plateau, now go to the next one. And it's simple things. It's not difficult things. Most times when people sit inside and they listen to me teach Empire, they'll say, oh yeah, that makes total sense. And it's like, because it's science, like it, I'm not, what I'm doing is not revolutionary. It truly is science. But it's more about the cadence and when you do them, right? The cadence and how and when you do it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So where are the best places on the internet for people to follow you, to find out about Empire, to find out about Aspire, to find out about, you know,
sure,
all the things?
Everything. Yeah, if you're interested in Empire, I would go to empireom.com. And a lot of businesses don't know what phase of business they're in. There's a 1 minute business assessment that actually will help them like track and go, where am I at and what is the next step? I encourage a lot of businesses to do that. But I still am in a place, my business partner, Dan, encouraged me to run my own social. I, for years, just let everybody else run it, answer all my things. And he said, I would encourage you for a year to try to run your own social. So I don't post everything on my social, but I actually like respond. I take all my DMs. I sit there and so Eddie Wilson Official, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, Facebook, you know, all of them, all the things. That's where I spend a lot of my time, is interacting with people and helping me understand, because that is my community, you know? And so being able to serve my community means that I have to still be in touch with that voice. And so I would encourage them to go to Eddie Wilson Official, and then everything kind of branches off from there based on needs.
Yeah. When you think about how many entrepreneurs, investors, we didn't even get to talk about your real estate investing and so many other things you've done. When you think about how many investors and entrepreneurs would like to accomplish what you have and so few have, What do you think is different about you? Or what do you think that you did differently?
You know, I tell this story a lot, and it took me 2 seconds, but I lost a brother and a sister when I was at a young age. My sister passed away, my brother passed away. My mom and dad, with extreme emotional intelligence, helped me process loss or difficulty. My mom would oftentimes, I would struggle, I'd cry, I'd struggle with like the loss of my sister, you know, specifically. And my mom would come and she would say, Eddie, you know, hey, you know, I know you're struggling I'm sorry for where you are, but tell me about your two favorite days that you had with Rebecca. Tell me about your favorite toy that she used to play with. Tell me about, and she would just constantly with just extreme, and think about that. The parents that had lost children now still being there for their children, you know, like as hard as it is to lose a sibling, I can't imagine with children now, I can't imagine the loss of one child, let alone two. And for my mom and dad to have such emotional intelligence to help me process loss served me in massive ways. Because when I went through the first company I sold and was taken advantage of, literally tens of millions of dollars, within 24 hours, I'd made the choice that instead of going, you know what, I can't believe I got taken advantage of, I can't believe, you're like, it wasn't good. I wasn't happy about it. You know, like I was really struggling, because you put your life's, you know, soul, your blood, your sweat, tears in it, and then all of a sudden somebody basically rips it from your fingers. And I made money, but I didn't make what I should have. It took me about 24 hours to the place where I was like, okay, I'm gonna play this game like they play this game. I'm gonna figure this out. And because every time that we go through loss, we go through struggle, it's really a fork in the road. And the fork is, you go right, and that right is the next ceiling. It's like, well, that's just who I am. I just get taken advantage of. This is just, I can't ever get a break, right? Like you begin to, all that self-talk creates a ceiling. The other path is, it's a catalyst, that every down moment, right? It's not the mountaintops that teach us, it's the valleys, right? Like it's the problems, it's the resistance while you're working out. It's all of the issues of life. And so the greatest issues of loss become the greatest catalyst for growth. And for me, every time I go through loss, I process it really through the lens of how my parents taught me to deal with loss. And that is, oh, this is going to be amazing what happens next, right? Like what I get to experience because of that loss is going to be great. That's the first big lesson. The second big lesson is watching my dad chase his dreams and succeed and fail and still be a great dad allowed me to avoid the traps of fear in my life. So if I can avoid loss and I can avoid fear making my decisions for me, it sets you up for a success that you don't even know is coming, right? Like I am so blessed because of the parents I had. I I am so grateful. I talk about every chance I get, because a dad who is always amazing, but also went through massive loss, massive success, mom that helped me process the loss of a you know, brother, sister, like that's the fabric of who I am and why I am successful. You know, if you can make your decisions based on pursuit, love, desire versus avoidance or fear, those are always right decisions. And then the second thing is if you can then experience loss and not allow it to set you back, but create a belief in you that the next thing is going to be even greater. There's a power in that I'm so blessed to have been taught. You know, and it's not me. I didn't bootstrap it. I didn't get this on my own. It was by some very amazing, loving parents that instilled this into me.
Wow. That is such a powerful answer. Thank you for sharing that. Makes me think a lot about some of my business failures and how much time do I spend crying in my milk versus deciding what I'm going to do about it, right? It's super motivating. Mm-hmm. Listen, this has been great. Thank you so much for making time to do this.
Thank you. It's been fantastic. I appreciate your show and appreciate all that you do for entrepreneurs.
Oh, so great. Okay, everyone.